Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
Yeah.
So this is a book called Beyond the Hoax.
By Alan Sokol, the physicist.
The dude who wrote Towards a Heuristics of Quantum Gravity.
Right, which is really...
No, hermeneutics, wasn't it?
I don't remember what it is, but the bigger the words, the better the nature of the parody. He wrote a parody.
Let me very quickly...
And we're still doing it today, actually. MIT guys, they wrote a program that would generate an abstract automatically, and they actually got at least one or more accepted to a conference.
So the Social Text was a journal in the 90s. And Alan Sokol, who was a physics professor or professional physicist?
I believe
physicist.
He was an academic. He is a physicist. Very bright guy. I like Alan.
You've met him?
No, I have not met him.
You like his
but
persona?
I've read his stuff. I think he makes a good point.
He wrote... Alan Sokol, S-O-K-A-L, wrote an article called Transgressing the Boundaries, Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. And then he submitted it to the Cultural Studies Journal, that's what he calls it, Social Text. And they published it in the spring 1996, special issue devoted to what they called the Science Wars. And then, after it was published, he went, aha, it's all crap, it's a parody, it means nothing, I just put together a bunch of pretty words. In essence, he did what we talked about last time, which is he, on purpose, used all the wrong metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
He used poetry and inapt theories and wrote nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But Social Text thought it was awesome. Do you have anything to say?
I just wonder how often that happens, because I have another theory.
He called it postmodern science criticism.
And the theory is that we as academics like to write things in the most complicated way so that people look and go, oh, I don't understand a word of that. It must be really important. Sometimes it is.
You remember that Shannon Zabransky,
sometimes it's not.
When she was on the show, she said that. She said that yeah. You know, academic writing didn't used to be impenetrable.
When did it become impenetrable? Because it's impenetrable now.
I don't know, man.
And there are people like Roald Hoffman, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, who are trying to make it a little less impenetrable. What would that be? A little more penetrable?
And he's a poet.
It sounds dirty. Sorry. I can't do Peter Griffin with my voice, but I could not resist. And he is also a poet. I think it would be...
Peter Griffin?
No, not Peter Griffin. Peter Griffin is a poet in my mind, but so is Roald Hoffman.
A poet of the open road.
For those of you that are aficionados of organic chemistry, perhaps you remember the Woodward-Hoffman rules about paracyclic reactions in aromatic compounds. That's the Roald Hoffman I'm talking about. So really bright guy, really nice guy. But he believes, and he said this in a poetry reading, that and he mentioned it to me afterwards.
In Sasquatch.
No, I don't believe he believes in Bigfoot or not.
Loch Ness
but I wouldn't
Monster.
Hold it against him. Look, a lot of bright people believed in the Loch Ness Monster. There's nothing wrong with believing
Are you confessing something, Pete?
No, I don't believe
did
in the Loch Ness
to
Monster.
Scotland?
I did,
did
not
you
go
to
Scotland.
The Loch?
But a guy by the name of Robert Rhines, who I have met, and I took a couple classes from him at MIT, really bright guy.
Was a cryptozoologist.
I guess technically, at least in hobby. He was a lawyer. He founded the Franklin Pierce Law Center.
Amateur cryptozoology is one of the most American things there is.
Right, but he didn't just, you know, interview people and play on the shore of Loch Ness and go, oh, look, scary things. He took his own money, rented a boat, and put side-scan sonar in the lock. So if you want to test it, get out there and use modern technology. He's a great innovator, inventor, really bright guy. And I believe his results were inconclusive. I don't think he really found any evidence of it. So his experiments are part of the reason why I don't believe there's a Loch Ness Monster. And then later, a lot of people that took those photographs, they came out later and said, look, they were doctored or forged or things like that. There's nothing wrong to say, is there some large sea creature in Loch Ness? But when you look at the evidence, you realize very likely no. So yeah. I don't believe in the Loch Ness Monster. So he took a very scientific approach to it. So you can't knock someone for saying, what if there is one, and then going out and checking. You can ask outrageous questions.
I can certainly knock them, but
you can't make outrageous conclusions in light of the evidence. And he actually did some very high-tech. I think his was one of the more high-tech experiments.
Well, so. Now someone has to give him a book about Bigfoot, so he can go do that.
No, that's perfectly fine. You know, the amazing Randy would debunk a lot of these
things. With all
the
drone technology, we should send cameras into the woods and find Bigfoot.
But I think all we would do is prove that Bigfoot likely does not exist.
Prove or find no evidence of?
It's hard to find no evidence of. It's hard to prove that negative. Yeah, that's why it's tough.
Is there any negative that's easy to prove?
Yes. When it's a simple system.
When it's sort of the presence in a contained system. Right.
Is there a peanut M&M in that bowl? That bowl is a very small, bounded, well-described system, but the entire forest of North America is not.
It is getting smaller. Maybe that's the larger project of urbanism is to find
all
Bigfoot.
The forest to find Bigfoot. And by the way, that's how we start all theories. Almost all theories are started...
By cutting down forests?
No, by describing a very simple system first. And then we try to expand it to bigger systems, and we sometimes find we have difficulty doing that.
What's your favorite theory?
Yeah, you asked me that before, and I mentioned what...
I'm sorry. What was the theory that came to mind when we were talking about Sokol?
Did I say there was a theory that came to mind when we talked about
it? I don't know. I'm pretty tired.
Okay, well, the theory that comes to mind actually has to do with polymer thermodynamics, believe it or not. The first thing is the mistake that the humanities people make is they're like, oh, if we had a theory with fancy, well-defined metrics that had quantitative equations that described it, then we'd be good and people would respect us. And that's a load of crapola.
I'm going to very quickly pull up the abstract.
Oh, for the hermeneutics? First of all, I'd like a definition of hermeneutics.
Ooh. A hermeneutic, it's like a...
You actually know what a hermeneutic is?
It's a law.
Sounds like something that happens in the back room in the Claremont Lounge, frankly.
Ooh, nice. Call
for
back.
For $10, I'll throw in a hermeneutic.
A hermeneutic is a theory. It's a way that you systematically approach certain texts. S/Z was written by Roland Barthes, right? That's what it looks like, but it's French. And it was talking about how you can pull apart a text, how you can interpret a text, how you can approach a text, whatever that might be.
Okay, it sounds like a linguistic or semantic theory.
Except for him, it was more
Now who's popping their peas?
Narratology.
Is that the use of brand name depilatories to remove hair from body parts?
Nicely done.
Narratology, is that a way of saying I'm going to tell it like a story in a narrative form?
No. The examination of narrative.
Oh, okay.
The hermeneutics in SZ are not about, this word looks like this word. It's more about how the story unfolds. Six Walks in the Fictional Woods by Umberto Eco. Mm-hmm. Is a discussion of hermeneutics.
Can you click on that Wikipedia link and see if you agree with your arch nemesis?
Well, I'm sure the person.
I still don't understand what hermeneutics are.
Here you go. This is Wikipedia. Hermeneutics is a theory of text interpretation, especially in the interpretation of biblical texts, wisdom literature, and philosophical texts. Hermeneutics was initially applied to the interpretation or exegesis of Scripture. It emerged as a theory of human understanding in the late 18th and early 19th centuries through the work of Friedrich Schleiermacher and Wilhelm Dilthey. Modern hermeneutics includes both verbal and nonverbal communication, as well as semiotics, presuppositions, and pre-understandings. I should let everyone know that the neutrality of this article is disputed. How can we have arguments about
hermeneutics?
My
seems pretty dry.
Oh, it's because
who gives a crap?
It's because Heidegger's in there. So,
oh, okay.
Anyway,
oh, so the when they say the neutrality is, it's probably attribution of who came up with the initial stuff,
and maybe even what it means.
Okay,
and whether Heidegger was a Nazi.
So it is a way to interpret texts.
Here,
I understand that, okay.
Is the first paragraph of Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity.
Does it have an abstract?
There are many natural scientists, and especially physicists, who continue to reject the notion that the disciplines concerned with social and cultural criticism can have anything to contribute, except perhaps peripherally, to their research. Still less are they receptive to the idea that the very foundations of their worldview must be revised or rebuilt in the light of such criticism. Rather, they cling to the dogma imposed by the long post-Enlightenment hegemony over the Western intellectual outlook, which can be summarized briefly as follows, that there exists an external world, whose properties are independent of any individual human being, and indeed of humanity as a whole, that these properties are encoded in, quote, eternal, unquote, physical laws, and that human beings can obtain reliable, albeit imperfect and tentative, knowledge of these laws by hewing to the, quote, objective, unquote, procedures and epistemological strictures described by the so-called scientific method. Whew! What do you think, Pete?
I'm reading the second paragraph.
Oh. Deep conceptual shifts.
I mean, I don't know what the heck that is.
Linguistic construct. Theory-laden and self-referential discourse of the scientific community, marginalized communities.
A lot. I think people are impressed by big words.
Well, at the time, I think that, you know, what was this, 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 20 years ago. This was new to a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, this, that first paragraph that I read, to me, is now cliche. And it's an extreme, mm-hmm. it's an extreme version of something that is true. You know, if you take out the belief that, okay, how to say this grammatically, if you take out of this paragraph that I read the critique that there is no external world, mm-hmm. then I'm pretty much in agreement with it.
Is he saying that relativism is okay?
I don't understand that, and I won't and acknowledge I reject it the question.
I won't acknowledge that you're even in this room with me.
No, I'm saying that it's true that science and the results of science are critiqued by the popular and cultural.
As well, they should be. Right, because science is part of who we are as humans.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
our
but
culture.
The popular and cultural gatekeepers.
Hegemony?
The hegemony, yes, thank you.
All right, what does hegemony mean?
The kingdom, dude.
Oh, is that really what it means?
Nah, I mean, yeah, no.
You're just talking crazy talk now. You're just making stuff up as you go along.
I am making nothing up. I'm just being, what do you call it? Vague. Hegemony. Leadership or predominant influence exercised by one nation over others in a confederation.
Okay. So the leadership in that field.
Yeah. Okay. But, I mean, all you have to do is look at...
Oh, wait. Go back to that. What was the word of the day? Rallentando?
Fucking God.
Oh, it'll change it. What is Rallentando? Go up to the top. Word of the day. Rallentando.
Slackening. It's what's
becoming
happening to your brain.
Slower. Adjective. So,
snap out of it. Okay.
So, it sounds like retard, as in...
we don't say that anymore.
No, the Italian word for slow.
I know. I played piano when I was a kid.
Which is what... Who was that? Zach Galifianakis?
Forte.
Who used it for someone who was mentally challenged? A retard. That was unfortunate. All right. Here's the deal. It doesn't matter if you're in the science part or the humanities part, doing what...
Or if you're just a person.
Shannon Dobrowski pointed, or if you're just a person, and filling things with complicated language keeps us from understanding the connection between physical theories and sort of sociological or humanities theories. And there is a connection, and it's sometimes very useful. Allow me to illustrate with an example.
Okay, but I am going to disagree with you hardcore.
That's okay. So say, for example, you're looking at stuff. Doesn't matter what the stuff is. Could be a narrative, right? Or it could be proteins. And you're trying to understand how the words and how they're strung together in a narrative.
This is your George Carlin bit. Say you're looking at some stuff. Could be stuff, could be narrative, could be proteins.
How come, what is it?
Could be a steak, could be a story.
Right, and how come your stuff is, their stuff is always shit and your shit is always stuff? Sorry, I couldn't resist. I love that bit. But, and the point is the idea of parsing these things, right? This is an important thing in linguistics, and it's also an important thing in biochemistry. You look at the order and you look at how they're arranged, and you try to predict what the narrative says based on how the words are arranged. I mean, this is semantic theory. This is linguistics. This is what these people do, and it's a very important theory. And it has ramifications not only in biochemistry, as I'm going to illustrate, but also in computer science and a lot of things. And then you look at proteins, and we like to look at the order of the amino acids in the proteins and say, look, simply by looking at that order, I can predict how the protein will fold and behave and have function to catalyze a reaction or to be a structural protein in a cell for the cell skeleton and things like that. That's an important theory for both those things, don't you agree? Right? Because one deals with meaning and language and interpretation.
It's such a high altitude similarity, though, right? I mean, the similarity is
all those similarities, they're pretty high altitude.
You know,
but let me show you a different similarity.
It's not like James Campbell. What was the who?
James Campbell. Didn't he star in? Wasn't he Ratso Rizzo's counterpart?
Monomyth. Who is the guy who studied who wrote Star Wars?
I don't know.
Was it Richard Campbell?
I don't know.
That's a joke. The guy who wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Campbell.
Is this like the 100 books you should read?
No, it's the exact opposite.
The Hero, it's crapola? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not that either. I'm saying that there was a guy. Back to the internet. You know, you walked in here and you're like, hey, you look good for a guy with, two babies
twins,
at home,
yeah.
And I think for about 3 minutes.
And now he's frustrated beyond all belief. No, so that basic idea, you're right, is
stop. We're going to get
30,000 foot.
James Campbell, Joseph Campbell, wrote a book that was all about the monomyth, the idea that kind of all religions, all origin stories, all these stories about heroes
have some similarities.
That there's almost a pattern, right?
Yeah.
Which is that predictive study that you're talking about.
Interesting in literature and interpretation. Yes, that sounds fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Yeah.
If you were to try and apply Joseph Campbell's monomyth theory to proteins, you would have a jumbled mess, I believe.
Not really.
Why do you say that? You don't even know what this book is.
So there are some interesting fundamental similarities, and I'm guessing what Joseph Campbell talked about is,
the
for
hero's
example,
journey is what he's describing.
Right.
You know, the leaving home.
One similar cultural story is
the mother.
The virgin birth.
You know, getting rid of the dad.
Very common
right.
in culture. We like to do the virgin birth because the virgin birth allows you to associate some figure, some hero with the divine, right? There was nobody had a martini, tried to get somebody liquored up, ended up in the back seat of a Chevy. You know, we don't like to deal with those non-niceties. But if it's a virgin birth, then, came directly from the divine, right?
Midichlorians.
Right, midichlorians. There you go. Another Star Wars thing.
The destruction of the Star Wars franchise in that moment.
But to be honest, you see some very common approaches to general theories of structure property relationships. You do. And we tend to repeat them over and over again.
Okay, I don't understand anything you just said.
It's a cultural thing.
And a lot
thing.
Of times I'm joking when I say that, but yeah. I really have no idea what you just said.
It's a cultural thing because we look for something that's conserved. We're not that bright. We write these conservation theories that energy is conserved. That's the first law of thermodynamics.
But are you going to connect us to the virgin birth, or am I supposed to already understand?
No, I'm just saying I can already see some similarities. But the similarity that I wanted to talk about is, yes, you look at the order of the words to understand the interpretation. You look at the order of the amino acids to understand the structure and function of the protein. But there's an interesting idea that some some of these elements, whether they're words or amino acids, have multiple meanings. And the meaning is contextual. Would you not agree that's sort of a fundamental idea in language and linguistics?
I think you're reaching, though, to say that that relates specifically to, a hero with a thousand faces.
So you brought in a hero with a thousand faces.
Right, that's
I'm not even there yet. But what I'm saying is, when you look at amino acids, sometimes you look at amino acids and say, look, this can be any one of this class, and it doesn't make a difference.
The background understanding that there is metaphor, that things can mean different things, that, that a meaning is slippery, especially in complicated situations.
That meanings change depending on context. That's true for both amino acids
absolutely.
And words.
However, if I were to say, let's take, boom, hero with a thousand faces, boom, that's me opening it up on the desk and saying, so, the hero's journey, the hero is the protein. And then try to apply that to what you're talking about?
That's just dopey.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so...
But I think very few people do. They say, let's go find a book on pop culture that's relevant to
RNA
phosphate backbones.
And that can
Nobody
make you feel
that.
Better. But that, you know, that's also a little bit of your improv and innovation thing. Like, let's go ahead and cook. Let's get the steam going. You know, two metaphors that I just tossed in there. When you go back to what Alan Sokol wrote as a joke, that it's dogma that there is an external world whose properties are independent of any individual human being, and that these properties are encoded in eternal physical laws, and that human beings can obtain reliable knowledge of the laws by using the scientific method.
Right.
So his joke is that that's not true.
Right. And my point is, one, that is dogma. But two, for the most part, it's true.
It's true.
Yeah. We can't have a relatively objective interpretation of the physical world. It's all a little bit, you know, and tweaked by our perception, but it's
the thing about
objective.
The external world, right, whether there exists an external world, that's kind of like you might as well go smoke a joint and drink a cup of coffee and talk with your friends about whether...
And gravity affects you in the same way. Your perception of gravity is very different depending on your nature of chemical imbalance.
I do not care if we are in the snow globe in a locker at a train station in a completely other universe. I do not care if there's another Charlie somewhere who right now is, I don't know.
Bizarro Charlie.
The problem I have with the multiverse thing is people always say, well, maybe there's one where I was never born. It's like, no, there's one where you turned left instead of right. There's one where you picked up a cup of coffee instead of a cup of tea. There's one where your eyes are green, not blue. There's one, you know, like.
And that's why I'm not a big fan of multiverse.
And what am I saying to you right now?
Until it's practical.
Every version of what I could say to you right now, including, you know, go away, Pete, or I'm in love with you, Pete, or let's quit this job and start a corporation, like each of those things. And that's three of an infinite number of possibilities, right? So who cares? I don't need that. I'm just not going to engage with that.
Well, when theories are new, nobody cares.
Yeah.
And nobody cared about quantum mechanics when it was new.
But also, when theories are bullshit, no one cares.
Oh, that's true. And that's immutable. No one ever cares. But at the beginning, nobody cared about relativity.
Einstein believes that hydrogen and stupidity were the most common elements of the universe. And I disagree with Einstein. He was not that smart a guy. It's clear that there's more bullshit than anything else.
I like that quote, though. Hydrogen and stupidity? On a quantitative nature, hydrogen is more likely to be common as opposed to stupidity. But in this country,
his joke here is a corruption of the idea that scientific consensus is interrogated at all times by non-practitioners.
Oh, but it is interrogated by all times by both practitioners and non-practitioners.
But I'm saying that this is what he's doing here. This is a corruption of that truth,
right? But that's how you sneak it in. You don't say something that's utterly stupid, like white supremacists. Supremacists? I don't even know how to say that word.
You don't.
They say just dumbass stuff. But you sneak something in by saying it's bald people that are leading to the downfall of society. And then the next thing you know, someone comes for you and me. And we got Kristallnacht, but for bald people all over again.
Also, and I feel
he was being a little more subtle.
I feel like I need to cut all that out. That's dangerous territory. There's also the theory that there are lizard people who run the universe, run the Earth, and people seem to connect to that just fine.
Do they? Who connects to the lizard people theory?
I mean, you know, this is an internet-heavy episode, but lizard people. List of reptilian humanoids. This is why Wikipedia sucks, dude. Check it. I want you to read that real quick, okay? List of reptilian humanoids.
Okay, but it says reptilian humanoids comprise a common motif of mythology, folklore, science fiction, fantasy, conspiracy theories, ufology.
UFOology.
Oh, UFOology.
UFOology.
Cryptozoology. Well, but I enjoy books on cryptozoology as science fiction. I think they're fascinating. Because they're an interesting story about what if there were reptile humans.
This is just making people crazy because it's the name of the article is List of Reptilian Humanoids, not List of Fictional Reptilian Humanoids.
Right, but they do kind of imply that it is pretty fictional.
For reptilian humanoids and conspiracy theories and ufology.
Oh, let's
see.
Reptilians.
Booyah. Look at that. You need to spend some time. Look at all these ancient astronauts, gray aliens, men in black, Nordic aliens. Oh, I need to read that.
But I don't believe in any of these alien theories because I have not seen any reproducible data that suggests that we've been visited by aliens. However, if I do the math on the universe and I think, is there a reasonable possibility that other advanced life forms could exist somewhere in the universe? The answer is yes. How would they get here? That's a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, the distances alone make it very unlikely.
If they find an Einstein-Rosen bridge and find a way to do interstellar travel. Okay.
An Einstein-Rosen bridge?
A wormhole. It's just the nerdy name for it. You know, that the universe, if you believe that multi-universes can exist, we can believe that the universe can fold back on itself.
See, this is when I just start to shut down.
No, that's okay.
Really? Is this something that we're actually spending time on?
No, I don't spend any
time
on it.
That's how I feel about it.
Right.
But then I feel like a Philistine.
But if suddenly a UFO landed and I saw the being get off the thing, I'd want to ask, how'd you get here? And we have theories for how that might happen.
And the alien would say something along the lines of, well, you know, the engine started to smoke, but then I gunned it.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work. Because, I mean, even if you can accelerate to infinitesimally close to the speed of light, we're a long ways from other stars and other galaxies, certainly.
And yet Stephen Hawking is afraid of aliens.
Wait a minute. You just made that up. Did you want... is Stephen...
No.
I don't believe that.
No, I'm not going to watch that movie. And I didn't make it up about Stephen Hawking and aliens.
But look, his psychoses is not my problem. I mean, I don't like spiders, but I don't believe
Stephen
they're going
Hawking,
to take over the world.
Humans should fear aliens.
Holy smokes.
To my mathematical brain, as opposed, I guess, to his cock brain, the numbers alone make thinking about aliens perfectly rational. The real challenge is to work out what aliens might actually be like.
Right. The probability of aliens existing is not zero. But how are they going to get here? That's the problem.
Advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads. They might exist in massive ships.
So basically, this is the scenario of Independence Day. Did he write that?
Well, so I feel like we've kind of circled around and sort of landed on nothing here.
So, I guess one of our conclusions is that metaphors between different areas and their theories can be useful and very often not.
I think strict application of what you see outside your field to your field is nothing short of madness.
But borrowing
but
the ideas.
Unstrict application, right? Allowing things to sort of, to allow your deep water to be filled with fish from other oceans.
Yes.
Is awesome.
And that's why we make people here at Georgia Tech have a humanities requirement and a social science requirement. And there is some value to the breadth of the liberal arts education.
Do you think that's, okay, no, that's interesting. At a certain point, we're telling people how to think, right?
God, I hope not.
If we say you need to have some extra stuff in your head, right? The stuff that's not vocational, stuff that's not professional, stuff that's not immediate to your work research concerns. That's work stroke research concerns. Mm-hmm. Aren't we kind of telling people this is how to think? This is how you should approach life.
No, I think we're saying based on our
experience.
I find
it interesting that you are so skittish about that thought. You are a professional educator, and you probably should be teaching people how to think.
Well, I share with them best practices for ways to approach thinking about a problem. But in terms of the details, no. And in fact, this semester...
Not what to think, but how to think.
Oh, how to think.
And also values. Yeah. This, I mean, it's a value to say that my... it's an inelegant phrase, but I feel good saying it. To say that your deep water should have fish from other oceans, which is, I guess...
I like that metaphor. That's
biologically
good.
Completely untrue, right? Because the fish should stay in their own places, right? Because you get the wrong fish and they eat each other and it's terrible.
Depends if there's shallow water or deep water fish.
And anybody who's right now saying, but it's all one ocean, I beg to differ. I was just giving them some space to be like, what the f***? And, you know, anyway.
Well, I mean, but we take advantage of the fact that some things move throughout the ocean.
Temperature changes are just as much of an obstacle as a brick wall when it comes to water and fish.
Maybe not exactly, but close. I mean, so for example, if you look at African lakes, I believe Lake Victoria is this way. And the reason folks here at Georgia Tech in biology and other folks like to study cichlids. Cichlids are a freshwater fish. And by the way, if you're looking, they're very colorful. Go to the Georgia Aquarium. Oh, is that a call to action? Well, we're not on the radio. I can say that. They have a great cichlid exhibit.
Right, you can say anything
you'll find
you want,
it
man.
Absolutely fascinating.
Why do you always forget that? Because it's been a few months.
I forget because I'm also on the radio. But the cichlids are in general shallow water fish. So what's interesting is they tend to stay near their little islands or reefs or shores. They don't move around because they don't swim in deep water. And then every once in a while, there's a little bit of mixture when the water level of the lake changes, right? So they actually stay in their own little area, kind of like the Galapagos Islands. So you get to see examples of evolution cichlids.
I'm having this sudden image of a bunch of fish who have sort of a suburban existential crisis because the water level changes.
And like, we don't hang out on that side of the tracks.
I feel so strange. I feel like the water's closing in on me, man, kind of thing.
So you're right. I guess we do.
That's a value.
I don't want to think
a value. And I think maybe you're going to have to accept that you're actually applying some
values.
And
I'm saying one of my values is
to the
your
you
breadth of
you're
understanding.
You're a brainwasher,
your
Pete.
Breadth
That's what
of
you have to
topics. But if and when
you're
one of my students
piper.
Or someone else can say, look, Pete, that's a load
leading
of crap.
Leading young people towards a cliff.
That's a load of crap. You don't need that stuff. Show me the example. I'm willing to explore that hypothesis. But right now, based purely on heuristics, I realize that a breadth of study can help you as an engineer, a lawyer, a writer. I think you should understand a little bit of all things, and that will help you in your chosen field.
It's not a laugh line, but we can stop there.
Okay. But do you disagree?
Right. I don't disagree.
Right. But the day that I see clear evidence that that's not the case, I'm happy to say, look, study just your area and your area alone. But I think there are useful metaphors that come from your area and other people's areas and things like that. And it's not only because I've used them, but, you know, maybe it just gives you the courage to think outside the box and say...
Wait. The first thing we need to do is to stop thinking that it's thinking outside a box.
Okay.
That's the first metaphor that we need to get rid of.
Okay, what metaphor do you prefer?
All I can think of is envelope. That's trouble.
No, but I...
Sideways, just, eccentric orbits.
How did we get to eccentric orbits?
I'm just saying that's how you should think.
No, I'm just saying just ask the what if question. I mean, let's go back to one of my favorite movies with Henry Winkler and Michael Keaton.
Night Shift.
Okay, what if we fed the mayonnaise to the tuna? Note to self, call StarCast. You know, what if? Okay, that's probably not very practical. But what if instead of light bending with gravity, light went straight and space bent? That's kind of what Einstein did when he talked about relativity.
What if I hit stop right now? Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK studios on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia.
What's that legal thing we have to do?
I think it's called a disclaimer.
Yeah, they don't care or want to know what we do here.